Took a while to find a mark that worked. Yes, good morning. Is there anything on there that's not spelled right? Getting anybody's OCD going there? That always happens. Yes, well, good morning and God bless you. I guess I didn't find out why Ron wasn't here. Is he okay, I guess, or oh, good? All right. The last time I was in the pulpit, I preached a message on, as you can see there, life and structure for multi-generational Jesus followers. And part two, I told you, was going to be the characteristics of a strongly bonded church. And that was kind of the last time I preached, was on kind of a preliminary message for this one. And I had this fantasy, I guess, that I was going to do I had 12 things I wanted to say about the characteristics of a strongly bonded church. And I'm going to get through 5 of them this morning. So just a little, I hope I will get through 5 of them. You can do it, have your Bibles open, the book of Hebrews, the 3rd chapter. But first I want to tell you just a little something that maybe will flesh out where we're going with this. What I tried to do in the last message is point out that it is not because we have better teaching in our churches that we have strong marriages and strong accountability and holy lives. It is because we have strongly bonded churches. That is where God intends that His gospel be lived out, and where we encourage one another and we disciple one another in the things of God. So the strongly bonded church is where discipleship happens, where we show one another and hold one another accountable to the Word of God. And that's how multi-generational Christianity works. And it's in the strong bond churches, the closely connected, tightly bonded churches, churches that have strong relationships with one another, where there's commitment. And I'd like to talk about that. And I'd like to get into some scriptures on that. I read several scriptures the last time. I'll probably go 2-3 of them this time. This past week, we went to my uncle's funeral. And it kind of ties into some of what I want to say this morning. My uncle would, of course, be Dwayne Whitaker's dad, Uncle Chuck, we always called him. He was 6'5" and very well known in Indiana, that part of Indiana. He had a deep, rumbly voice and had a kind of a way of just being a calming influence wherever he went. He would start speaking and people would just quiet down and just listen. That's just the testimony that he had. He came out of I'll just call it the evangelical world, but it was kind of more of an independent, almost home church evangelical world. Married my Aunt Judy and spent the rest of his life, raised 4 children, spent the rest of his life pretty much in the same area there in Indiana and amongst the German Baptists and became a church member. And I just want to point out something about that. It really stood out to me that he stayed there all his life right there, and there was a very large funeral and a lot of people came to the viewing and it was kind of a big deal. But his whole side of the family that would be from out there, there was what? Could have been maybe 20 or 30 people there total out of, I don't know how many came through, but it could have been 1,000 possibly, maybe more came through at the funeral and the viewing. Well, does that matter? You know, does the testimony of his life matter? Maybe, you know, my wife's probably going to go to a funeral this week, and she was just told this morning that, well, we'll wait on you. There'll probably be nobody there, and some of her family will be there, and it's an aunt that's kind of on the other end of the world. She was in a strongly bonded church, and now she's, you know, last I knew, I think she did attend church some towards the end of her life, but mostly she watched Charles Stanley on television on Sunday mornings for a good chunk of her Christian life after she left the church she was a part of. Well, we could say, well, that's sad. You know, one left a testimony that is, multi-generational, the other, not so much. But you know, if it's just a system, if it's just, we created something that's beautiful, it's good, it's family-oriented, and it goes on generation after generation, well, that's, that we may like it, but is it biblical? That's the question I would like to ask ourselves this morning. And so let's go to Hebrews chapter 3. And I would just like you to see a few things here about Hebrews 3. And we will see there in the, if I can get my eyes on it, 13th verse. You're going to see that famous verse, but exhort one another daily while it's called today. But I'd like us to see a little bit of the context. The context of it is faithfulness in the house. If you look at the fourth verse, we could go to the third verse. This man was counted, it's Moses, was counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who hath builded the house hath more honor than the house. And points out that Moses was faithful in his house. He was faithful in the house of God. He was faithful in being a part of and leading the people of God. And it keeps on going, but it points out in the sixth verse that Christ, as a son over his own house, get there, whose house are we? We are the house of God. And Christ is over the house of God. We want to see that clearly. The sixth verse, third chapter of Hebrews. I'd like to see this very clearly. So then, and he talks about, of course, the whole book of Hebrews is warning. If you want to know what the book of Hebrews is about, it's warning. You can fall away if you don't hold your faith steadfast to the end. That is, if there's anything the book of Hebrews is about, it is that. So he keeps on going. He talks about those who are always there and they're provoking me in the wilderness. In fact, the third and the fourth chapter are primarily that. We're going to go to 1 Corinthians 10 eventually here, but the same idea is there. The children of Israel were called out of Egypt. They were a part of the people of God. They were the household of God. That's what Hebrews 3 and 4 is saying. They were a part of the house of God. And yet, their carcasses fell in the wilderness. They were destroyed because the individuals who had not faith died. They were destroyed in the wilderness. So being in a part of the house of God, being in a strong bond church, does not guarantee salvation. We can think of it that way. Being a strong bond church does not guarantee salvation. So let's think about that just a little bit more. We'll keep going. So I swore in my wrath, 11th verse, they shall not enter my rest. And then the 12th verse, take heed, brethren. Take heed, brethren. Whenever you see the word take heed. Watch, listen, be careful, beware. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Okay, good. We've all been warned. Individually, we feel the responsibility to keep our faith sound and going forward. But now look, notice the 13th verse. But exhort one another. So how do we do that? How do we keep from falling away? How do we stay, not go away from the living God? But exhort one another daily, while it's called today, lest in any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. So I guess you see the connection. I hope you do. So the whole warning is built. I think that one of the crux verses in this whole passage is that we are responsible to one another. That's what strong bond churches do. We hold each other accountable. We exhort one another. Notice it didn't say, the preachers are supposed to do it. It says exhort one another. It doesn't say just sit in your pews passively, listen to a sermon, and go home and live your life. There is a daily exhorting of one another. That's what strong bond church looks like. Okay, I'm going to jump over the 10th chapter of Hebrews. Some of the same ideas, still the same idea of a house and the household of God. And I'm just going to read that instead of skipping through it. And I'm going to read through, I guess I was trying to decide here. I think we'll just start in at the 19th verse, Hebrews 10, 19. And I'd like you to see the same idea of falling away, the idea of danger, and our responsibility one towards another. And the other thing I want you to notice is that there's an assumption that you will be a part of one another. It's not like, you know, I know you're kind of fragmented, but you need to kind of get in the church. We're going to see that there's an assumption that you are there already. That if you are a Christian, you are in a strongly bonded church. So maybe just start at the 19th. Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, which he hath consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. And having a high priest over the house of God, notice again that house of God concept that we saw in the third chapter, 22nd chapter, verse, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. A lot of individual. This is important. We need to get this as individuals. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful, the promised. And let us consider, this is the 24th verse, let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Let us consider one another. That means that we are to be paying attention to one another. Got to have each other on our minds. That's what that means. I looked that up this morning just to see what was there, and it's a kind of a strong word. It has the idea of like we would consider our children or consider our wife, that we have them kind of there on our consciousness to provoke unto love. Provoke unto love and to good works. 25th verse, famous verse, not forsaking the assemblies of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. Now I want you to notice, you'll see the 26th verse, for if we sin willfully, and some of the scariest verses in the Bible, it follows from there. For if we sin willfully, and it talks about the don't do it. You know, there is a no more sacrifice for sin. The sixth chapter is a little bit that way too. The sixth and the tenth chapter is no more sacrifice for sin. And the antidote to this falling away and this coming to a place of sinning willfully, the antidote to that is to exhort one another daily while it's called today and to be a part of the church. Be assembled together regularly. And there's a lot of scriptures we could go to, and I think maybe the next time I come, I've been putting together quite a few scriptures on it. It's, I don't know, multiple pages. I'll probably have a printout in the back of some of the scriptures that I would point to beyond this. It's, front and back, at least four sheets of paper, just on God's heart for the church and the assumption that we will be a part of it, not just going to it. And I will probably say this more than once. We don't just attend church, we are the church. We belong to the church. It is who we are. It's our identity. It's the family of God. That, as it says here in Hebrews, the household of God. And we'll see that word come up a little bit more as we go. The urgency of exhorting one another. So I'm going to start in on five of the points. And the first one is that the strongly bonded churches, biblical churches, are churches made up of born-again believers. That should be, you know, no-brainer. Why don't we just skip that? We all know that's true, right? But I would like you to think about John 3. You're all very familiar with John 3. John 3 is where Nicodemus comes to Jesus by night, and he doesn't understand what Jesus is saying. And Jesus says something very interesting. He says, art thou a master in Israel and knowest not these things? You're a master in Israel. You are the church of Jesus Christ. I'd just like to transfer Jesus' rebuke to Nicodemus. I'd like to transfer that rebuke to us. You have it all together, Nicodemus. You have it all together, Gospel Light. You've got your doctrines in a row, Gospel Light. You teach from the pulpit. You're the teacher of those who need taught. You have a lot of understanding, Gospel Light, but know ye not that ye must be born again I'd like you to just get the connection there. We forget it, don't we? Nicodemus had his ducks in a row, doctrinally, the Old Testament doctrines. He wasn't rebuked for his ignorance of Jewish thought. But he must be born again. So whatever I would say in all these messages, it'll be at least one more, I would like us to just understand from the outset that we can get I got about a dozen points. We get all dozen points right. And if we're not right with God, we don't have a new and transformed heart. We just simply have a system. We just have an external system. But I would also like to make, and we'll see this as we go, that doesn't mean we throw out the church. So we need to put these together, and I'll talk about that a little more in depth. So just some analogies I would use. It's been done multiple times. In fact, they keep trying it. They're making cells nowadays with the nuclei and the DNA and the RNA and the mitochondria. They've been able to put all those proteins together and create a cell. But so far, they've not been able to get it to live. It doesn't reproduce. It doesn't consume. All the definition of whatever life is, they haven't been able to do it. They've kind of monkeyed around. They've got a few odd. They made a virus or two that's done some replicating. Very simple proteins. My point is that we can describe and maybe even build a cell, but it's God who gives the life. So we can do everything right, but if God has not poured his life, he's not breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, spiritually speaking, we are still dead, even if we have it right. You can put a fireplace up. A mason can do that. My brother-in-law is a mason, and he builds beautiful rock fireplaces in million-dollar houses. And mantles and hearths and get the chimney all right and the stainless steel and all the blowers to get the heat to come out of it and do it all. But if there's not wood and fire in there, it's just a fireplace. And it might be ever so beautiful, but it does nothing without fire in it. The 10 virgins, I don't know how beautiful their lamps might have been. Some of those lamps might have been very intricate. It might have been very decorative, but there wasn't oil in them. I just want us to see that God must breathe into our nostrils the breath himself in our eyes, the Spirit of God. It's breath of God. Years ago, as we were in Tennessee, and I was trying to wrestle around whether we was going to move there or not, and I was walking on the road, and Alvin Yancey, he was a dear man. I'd like you all to meet him someday. Probably won't happen, but he was a very personable man and a young fella, not about my age, a little older. And I asked him, I said, "Well, Alvin, do you feel like everyone in the church here is born again?" He just kind of looked at me. He was riding his horse there. He was a horse trainer. I was down on the ground. He just looked at me for a bit. And he says, "Well, Clint, that's an odd question. I hope so. I think so." He said that's kind of was his answer. And I would like to say the same. I would like to say that we, I believe, here at Gospel Light, as far as I know, best I can tell, everyone here that's old enough and been baptized is a born-again believer. But only you know in your heart where you're at with God. There's people out there that it's kind of an interesting trait. I found this to be true as a pastor. It seems like when people maybe are struggling, maybe they're doubting their salvation, maybe they're struggling with deep sin. And it seems like if the pastor assumes that everything's okay, they lose respect for the pastor. It's like they, ask the right questions. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder, am I asking the right questions? But I want to say, I am assuming that until I know otherwise. But there is the possibility that we have distractions. It's hard to be in a strongly bonded church today. It takes time. It takes energy. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. It takes commitment. There takes financial commitment in some cases to be a part of the believers. And one of the things that there in the sower and the seed, it talks about these people who are choked. The word has been choked. What is it? The cares of this life, the deceitfulness of riches. And it just talks about the busyness. We're in America. If there's ever a time in the history of the church that people can be distracted from bringing fruit, I think in one of the versions it says bringing fruit unto perfection, we are there. So even though we're born again, there's still a lot of temptations and there's a lot of distractions. And they're both very, very real. Jesus didn't say it. He talked about the deceitfulness of sin. But I wonder if we ought to just say the deceitfulness of distraction today. It seems like that's an awful lot of it. So we'll talk about some of those things as we go along. Number two is we convey the beauty of the kingdom life. We convey the beauty of the kingdom life. So we're going to have multi-generational Christianity. And Chris spoke about it today. There's no sense in talking about the Christian life if we're not joyful, if it's not fun, if it's not good. You know, we've spent too much time. I think some of the modern CCM type songs, you know, life is hard, life is terrible, and, you know, the hard road and everything's terrible. But Jesus, in the end, it's going to be all right. And that's not really exactly what the Bible teaches, that you may have life and that you may have it more abundantly. Yes, life will be hard, but He is the reward. He is the rest, even now in this life. We're not just going through a hard slog until we get to heaven. We need to convey to our children that we are joyful. It's good. We're not grumpy about it. We're not just bearing with it. You know, I knew a man one time, he saw the Christian life as hard. And that's just what he conveyed. It's what he conveyed to everyone around him, is how hard it was to live the Christian life. It didn't work out too well in his testimony. In Ephesians 2, and I'll just read this to you. This is what we were. Life is hard. The wages of sin is death. He made, and you, talking to you at Gospel Light, Ephesians 2, 1 through 4, and you He made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all conducted ourselves in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as others. But God, who is rich in mercy, because of His great love with which He loved us, and there's a parenthesis, and it goes on, and I talked about that one other time. The parenthesis is how God saves us, and then, I believe it was the last time, and then, you know, that's Ephesians 2, and grace, we're saved, and then it goes into church life. It goes, the parenthesis is how we're saved, and then what it looks like is a life in the church. As it continues on there in Ephesians 2, I think the last verse is glory in the church, if I have that right. So that's where we were. That's where we were. But I think that we need to understand that the devil wants to keep us there, and he wants to make it look good. My question is, are we making the kingdom look good? Are we joyful? Are we happy? Are we living it? You know, I've been involved sometimes with people who it seems like they know the Christian life. They've got a lot of Bible knowledge. I think they're probably born again. And yet somehow it's not working. I don't know what to call it. The gospel isn't really working. Depression, anxiety, poor marriages, bad relationships, addictions. So yes, we have those issues, don't we? You know, somebody said to me recently that, you know, it was kind of secondhand, but they were talking about how, those plain people, they think they got it all figured out, but they got the same problems we do. And yes, that's true. Many times we do. But the difference is we hold each other accountable and we minister to one another. We come alongside of each other and we disciple one another. And sometimes we put one another in discipline when that's what it's called for. So we don't just wallow in it. Yes, there is those issues. The devil has I'd call it the devil's con. You know, he has convinced people in America that we can have it all. We can have our independence. We can have Hollywood. We can have the music industry. We can have technology. We can have everything America has to offer. And somehow we've got our fire insurance. We're going to go to heaven and everything's going to be okay. That is the devil's con. That is the devil's lie. The reality is we can't have our independence. Everything I see in the Bible says we're going to have to be inside the church of Jesus Christ. That we can have independence and a life of fruitfulness. We can have our certificate of fire insurance and the American dream. And the devil never tells us what the end will be. He never will. In John 10, it says this, I am the door of the sheepfold. Think about that. I am the door of the sheepfold. What is the sheepfold? It is the church. Upon this rock, I will build my church. It's the door of the sheepfold. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal and to kill and destroy. I am come that they might have life and they might have it more abundantly. Do we get that? Are we conveying the beauty of the kingdom life? Jesus said, the devil comes to steal and to kill and destroy. But I think a lot of times we don't believe it. I've talked to somebody recently and they were kind of dabbling a little bit. They weren't in sin yet. Don't get me wrong. But they were dabbling. They were kind of moving over, getting close. And I warned them. You know where this ultimately can go. Yeah, I know. I don't want to go there. And after we talked a little bit, I said, I'm afraid what I'm hearing is that you want to get just far enough that you get a little taste of it without falling off the edge. A little silence. Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. And we don't, the devil, that's the devil's trick. The devil likes to trick us and think we can go, oh, it won't catch me. You know, drugs is probably the extreme example of that. Yeah, I can, you know, shoot up a little heroin and it'll be fine. It isn't. That might be the final slide into skid row and damnation. We cannot, the devil does that. I was just thinking about some examples and I don't think I had the time. How many of you heard the story of William, the boy that ended up with the Amish. He ended up in a truck in the Amish. Anybody heard that story? Dale Gish told it at a Bible school. I just read a follow-up to that story. I've read that story a couple of times. I heard the story. Dale Gish told it at a Bible school. And I'm just going to jump to the second part. He ended up, very interesting story. Well worth your time to read. I ought to get a couple copies and pass it out. I've read it more than once and it always brings tears to my eyes. Well, the follow-up to the story is, now he's in the strongly bonded church, he's with the Amish, apparently pretty spiritual-minded, the way it's kind of in a tract form, I read it. And his son, Robert, doesn't want to be a part of dad's life. I'm not going to be Amish, I'm out of here, don't want nothing to do with it, you can't talk me out of it. During this time, when Robert was in this shaken place, this William began to searching for his family because he had very little information. He knew he never met anybody that anybody ever called dad. He wasn't sure about mom. He had a couple of people that he thought were half-sisters, and somehow he traced them down there in Chicago. So he made some arrangements and finally got some of the family, decided, yeah, we can meet you in Chicago. And it's very interesting how that must have happened, this long-bearded Amishman meeting his long-lost relatives in Chicago. That could have been probably pretty interesting. But anyway, he decided to take Robert along. He just felt like God told him to take Robert with him. And Robert was a rebel. Robert didn't want anything to do with it, but he went along with Dad. And of course, then they met at this community center, apparently. And all his relatives, a good chunk of his relatives were there, half-sisters and half-brothers, and just a hodgepodge of people. And it was Robert's job to write down these relationships. This is the third marriage, And he got so confused, he finally just gave up. He just couldn't put all the mess of a disaster of these relationships together. It was just, you can just imagine. In the midst of that, there was this little Joey, and he was a Down syndrome boy. There would have been some kind of a half relative of his. I don't think he had any full-blooded relatives there in Chicago, at least. He never did find out who his dad was, for sure. Anyway, Joey was there, and he was a Down syndrome boy and kind of running around, kind of lost. And one of the parents was there taking, you know, was responsible for him. But the other parent was coming and going to meet there at this community center where they were at. And to pick him up, they took turns taking care of this Joey. And they got it there, and pretty soon this loud hollering from the foyer. And they were arguing about who was going to take Joey. No, you have to take him. No, it's not my turn. You have to take him. They were just having a big old fight over Joey, not to get him, but to get rid of him. And it got quiet there in the room. And William stood up. He said, "Quiet." He said, "If nobody wants Joey, I'll take him." I don't know how it could have been so easy, but yeah, they all agreed, just take him. So he took Joey home. And William, he wrote it out there. He said, "My son Robert was very quiet on the way home." Just the chaos on the one side and the order in the other. One didn't want Joey and the other did. Robert was quiet on the way home. A couple weeks later, came to Dad and he said, "I want what you've got." I don't know, young people, I think it sometimes irritates you. We have brothers' meetings, we talk about whatever it is, you know, technology, music, clothes you wear, maybe higher styles. We talk about these things. I know it feels irritating to you. I know it does. Talk to a few of you. I hope you can understand that the brothers' meeting is the place where discipleship happens and where those bonds are built and where we maintain and build these strong bonded connections that make all the difference for multi-generational Christianity. I hope you can accept it and see it as, yes, irritating at times, and sometimes it don't even make sense. I'm 55 years old, and there's some in the room older than I am, and I've seen a lot. And I haven't seen very much come out of just letting it all go because somehow we've got the Spirit of God, we just need to leave everybody alone. It doesn't seem to work. It doesn't seem to work. We don't just go to church. And this is one of my favorite verses, and you know it is. "Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens." You know, we're not Americans. We are fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God. We don't march. I think last time I talked, we don't march to the tune of the American drum. We march to the tune of Jesus, our King. And He is the head of our house, which is God. We're built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, fitly framed together, tightly bonded. I read several of those verses last time. Fitly framed together, groweth into an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. You know, the church of God looks a lot more like a family than it does a club. It's not just a motorcycle gang. It's not just a skiing club. It is a family. Tightly knit. I'd like us to see some of these things in a different light sometimes. You know, I told the story of William and Robert. And we need to, you know, every once in a while we need to just see that world out there doesn't have anything to offer. Hollywood is not our friend. It's out to destroy us. I just talked to a man the other day. He's one of those with some temptations in his life, and he's not in our circles at all. He said, if I was going to keep my Christian faith, I had to stop watching television. Hollywood is not our friend. You know, I think about, you know, we talk about, you know, we have some standards on social media and technology. I don't want us to see things that we've taken things away from us. We've given us something. We have discipled one another in our brothers' meetings, and we have given ourselves a gift. And the gift is real relationships with real people in real time, face to face, healing relationship, confessing our faults one another and gathering together one with another. And it's something, it's a gift to ourselves from God. God wanted to give it to us, but Satan wants to take it away. I'm reading a book called Stolen Attention, I believe it's called. What's that? Stolen Focus, yeah. Stolen Focus. And, you know, it's interesting that I probably should cover this at a different time. It's not in my notes, but it's on my mind at the moment, I guess. But he talks about, he's a best-selling author and wrote another book that I read, so it caught my attention. The tech industry is, it's not a conspiracy. It's not like they're bad people with horns on their head and hooves and tails. They're not the devil. It's just the whole industry is built around profits and getting people to focus on their phones and on technology is how they make their profits. And so they have engineers sitting around day after day, week after year, year after year, with one purpose: to get us addicted to technology. That is their purpose, and that is their stated purpose. Some of them hate it. In fact, it was interesting, they quoted several of them in the book as saying they won't let their children on this stuff because they know it's destroying them. May I just say one last thing on that, and it's not my subject. One of the things the book pointed out, and it became very clear as I was continued to read, it is such a strong addiction. The individuals, even the smartest people, there's people out there with high intelligence and lots of self-discipline, and they get caught in it. The only way to get out of it is they have to put barriers in their life. And we have done that as a church. I think I just want you to see it as a good thing, not a bad thing. It's a gift. It's a blessing. Not a law that somehow something's being taken from us. We have freedom from mind-numbing entertainment, fashions. You know, people spend millions of dollars a year. I don't know, the industry is billions of dollars a year on just changing their clothes constantly. We're free from broken homes on the whole. Yes, we have some bad marriages at times, but on the whole, we don't have broken homes. Meaningless, self-focused loneliness and a fear of death. You know, I was there at that funeral. It's interesting how joyful at some level this funeral was. He's 81 and a half years old, a good testimony behind him. No one doubts his salvation. As my brother-in-law preached the message. And he went to, I call you not servants, but friends. Because in the last hours of Uncle Chuck's life, they were singing a song, which the German Baptists sing all the time. What a friend we down the wind. I wonder, well, there's one there is above all others, and it's about his friend, being a friend. And they were singing that song, and he hadn't said much. He got to the point he was pretty quiet, wasn't saying much. And he said, I have a friend. His name is Jesus. I have a friend. We do not need to fear death. Because we have a friend. We have a freedom from addictions, venereal disease, divorce, and just plain old loneliness. They call that an epidemic. That's the modern epidemic, they call it today, is loneliness. Loneliness. And it kills, actually does. It kills people. Loneliness is one of the most devastating diseases in that it weakens us to all the other diseases. But I want to say this, we have not invented a great system. We would love it if it was just a great system. I would like to say, and I hope we've hopefully shown this, it is just simply a matter of taking the Bible seriously. As a church, as a people. We're not doing anything weird. We're not doing anything strange. We've just decided the Bible is real, that what it says is true, and we're going to live it personally and corporately together. And out of that comes strongly bonded churches. Let's teach that. So the second thing, and it's kind of 2A, it's not really of the five, it's only two, it's still number two. A strongly bonded church reaches to the real needs and the felt needs in the congregation. There's real needs, which we know. You know, sometimes people have needs, they have a felt need that isn't really a need, it's a want. And sometimes it's wrong. But we need to reach to the real needs and the felt needs of the congregation. And that can be in preaching. You know, I was in, I guess I shouldn't say where I was at, but I was preaching in a congregation one time, and all I did was preach a very simple message on marriage. It wasn't profound. It wasn't amazing. I think it was just simply, I'd preached a wedding recently, and that's what was on my mind, so that's what I preached. And it was more of a traditional Mennonite-type setting. I got done, came down into the hallway, and I was surrounded immediately by four or five of the brothers, maybe a sister, I don't remember, but four or five of the brothers. And they were just all over it. They said, "Brother, thank you. We don't get practical messages. We get a lot of doctrine, but we don't just get practical messages." And so I felt a little overwhelmed. I wasn't expecting that kind of a response. But it was a starved congregation. It was a congregation that felt hungry for just a practical message on marriage. Something as simple as that. We have to, a strongly bonded churches, we need to be filling the needs. I told somebody recently, in fact, I've said it more than once, if our congregations are not getting fed, they will go somewhere else. That's just the way it works. You know, we have this, you know, no secret, I guess, you know, this Texas group. I don't know what we're calling them, but that's what I keep hearing them called. And I think a lot of churches are running scared of them. I don't think we need to if we keep feeding the congregation, if we just keep doing that. When church commitment seems disconnected from its contribution in my life, the church requires a lot of us, don't it? I mean, we have expectations, we have standards, but somehow if it's not meeting, it's not contributing anything to my life, we start feeling uneasy. We start feeling out of sorts. A church may teach good values and standards, but if in our heart we know these things are not solving the broken in our lives, if we somehow doctrine, we get it all in a row, we get it all figured out, and yet I'm struggling. You know, I think about it in, you know, a lot of times I go to Bible schools and the young people are it's the whole courtship thing is usually what's really driving them nuts. They just don't know how am I ever going to get married? How am I ever going to meet a girl? Whatever. And so that's a felt need. And I think it's a real need. And I think we as churches, if we're going to maintain strong bond churches, we have to address these things. We have to find, you know, what is the hindrances? What is the roadblocks? What are the little catches that aren't working? And we need to make a strong bond church work. We have to be solving some of those problems that are real. Because they're going to, twist and turn. You know, it's like, you're asking me to do this, but you're not solving my problem. And that's something we as elders, that's some of our tasks, Chris and I in ministry. Sometimes maybe in the Agape meetings, I'm kind of hoping to talk about that particular subject at the Agape meetings sometime. Just how do we get over some of the hurdles? Maybe we've got a hurdle here and other churches don't. Maybe we can solve that. I was just was with a father recently, and he has one of his children is not doing well, and kind of gets close to the kingdom and then backs away, and gets close to the kingdom and backs away. And so I was talking to the father a little bit. We were working through some of the things, you know, what's going on, and he said, "Well, I had an interesting conversation." This is more like a third or fourth conversation I've had with this father, and he said, "I just had an interesting conversation this past week." This child sat down beside me and said, "Dad, you've always just said no. It's always been no. No matter what I want in life, no matter where I'm going, it's always no." And I feel like that I want to give my heart to God, but I'm afraid He'll always say no. And I don't know, we spoke a little bit more about that, but I want us to know that if we're going to have a strongly bonded church where our youth want to be a part of us, it can't always be no. It needs to be yes to the good things. It needs to, we need to be guiding our youth to find, you know, be wanting good things, of course. But if it's always no, and it's always disapproval, you know, if young people feel disapproved of all the time, they feel like they're always, you know, I can't ever please anybody. And it's always no. And then pretty soon they're always trying to figure out a way to avoid us. Us old ones, us gray-bearded ones. We need to be coming alongside and saying yes to good things for our young people. They need to be allowed to ask questions. They need to be allowed to make mistakes. We need to have a place of safety for our young people to flounder around. They do. They're trying to find out who they are and what they are. And we'd just like to tell them, wouldn't we? But sometimes they need a little space to figure it out. We need to be working together with our young people. It needs to look possible for them. And it needs to look beautiful to them. You know, I think a lot of our young people are perfectly glad to give up their freedom if it's for a pearl. You know, that man that found that pearl of great price, he went and sold everything he had, bought the field so he could have that pearl. The treasure in the field, I guess. That's the one. I think both of them, they sold everything they had to buy the pearl of great price. If it's truly a pearl, but if it's going to be just a piece of firewood, you know, they're not going to sell all they have. And our job is as the leaders and the older people in our strongly bonded churches is to walk alongside of our young people and show them the pearl. Show them that it is a pearl. Maybe the devil would like to make it look like dung. He didn't make it look like it's hard, it's oppressive, it's robbing me of my fun. In reality, in the long run, it's joy, it's gladness. Now, I just like to balance that, and it probably needs balanced in more ways than one. If someone is living in violation of clear expectations and no norms, they should not be surprised that they feel disapproved of. Sometimes it's just a matter of, hey, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit in the dress issue in a different context. But, you know, there is, you know, he's always disapproving of it. Sometimes it's not that hard to come into inside the approval. They just don't want to. So that's my balance in that. Number three, in a strongly bonded church, child training is important. Raising up the next generation of Jesus' followers is very integrally built into a strongly bonded church. I think if you would really look at, you know, maybe I think about Gary Miller going to China with, I forget who it was anymore, but anyway, went to China and they were discipling church leaders. And one of the things that came back with was intrigued me was the concept of godly homes was just something that just wasn't there. He said it was just interesting, it just wasn't there. I don't know, how's that feel in Africa, Preston? Is it a little bit that way too? Just the idea of, it's like I got saved and I guess I hope my children do, but I'm not really got much responsibility in it. That's what he felt like when he went to China. But I believe that the strongly bonded churches, the biblically knit together churches, have a sense that, what, you know, if I go compass land and sea to make proselyte and I lose all my children to the devil, what good is that? I think there's a sense that, I think we feel that real strong, don't we? Denny Kennison, kind of, that was one of something he emphasized. The whole idea of passing on the faith to the next generation. The problem is that I think maybe we emphasize child raising outside the context of church. And I hope we can get that. And I'll just make some notes. I made some notes on it. Maybe it'll come out here. I have some thoughts on connecting, raising up the next generation for Jesus Christ to become an honor and a testimony for Jesus is good. But it has to happen around the table. It has to happen with mommies and daddies. But it has to also be, to really work out, it has to work out in the context of the church. I have over and over, and maybe I'll just put this in here, I have been blessed again and again with my children as they have embraced the identity of gospel-like Christian fellowship, and the older men and the stable families here, they just do. They're sitting in front of me, and they can. And if they don't agree, they can raise their hand. I have taught them, and they have taken it up, that there is a beauty in being a part of the family of God. And they admire the people here. They look up to the people here. And part of the reason why that works so well is I am not a perfect father. I don't need to say that. You know that. I'm not even sure I'm a good father. I'm not sure where I rank, but I don't think I'm that great at all. But I'm not the only, quote, father in their life. They can see other fathers. They can see other mothers. And they can see other examples. And we can be doing this together to be able to point my children to other people in their lives. Church has to be a part of that. But if I am always having, I just heard a new term recently, you know, barbecued preachers, for instance, or boy, the brothers meeting, boy, that was a mess, and it didn't go well, and brother so-and-so, he's not doing well, and you know, you're just constantly criticizing the church in front of the children, what are they going to get out of it? They're going to get out of it that, well, mama, that is not perfect, and it looks like nobody in the church is, and it's going to be a disaster. I can just promise you it'll be a disaster. So, a couple points I'll make. Parents need to get right with God and with each other. The greatest gift a father can give to his children is to love their mother and vice versa. They need to have their emotional life in balance. And I know that's not always easy, but it needs to be there, especially in putting off anger. I've said this multiple times on the pulpit, but I'm going to say it again. When I sit in a prayer room with a young person at a Bible school and they're wrestling really hard, most of the time, it's because they have an angry parent somewhere. Anger is just needs to be out of any parenting. Put off anger. We need to be breaking down the devil's barriers to our children, seeing the beauty of holiness and embracing biblical Christianity. There's enough barriers. The devil's got a job he's doing. This don't make his job easy. The other thing I'll point out is that we need to be intentionally catechizing our children. I haven't used that word in a long time, but it's kind of come to me recently. This idea of taking the Bible and making it alive to them daily. This, we don't put it off. Family devotions. I've probably said this before, and I know I have. I'm just going to emphasize it again. In the background I came from, there was a lot of failure in child raising. And it was almost systemic. It was just kind of a part of their culture. But the families that did well, generation after generation, were the ones where family devotions was a part of their life. It just was. I figured that out at an early age. I realized there is a difference. And the difference is the Bible in the home on a regular basis made all the difference in the world. A lot of them, that's one of the things that happens at a strongly bonded church. We get to the point we think, well, the church is going to raise my children. You know, they just kind of flow in and it all just kind of happens. And I hope they join the church someday. But that's not how it works. We need to protect our children from addictions and cravings and lustful curiosities. Be watchful of your children. This is not a child-raising message, so I'm going to go quick. We need to have a vibrant, joyful church life that parents and children enjoy. And that enjoyment can open up their ears to the voice of God. They're not going to close their ears. They're going to open their ears because mom and dad are enjoying church life. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. I want to be a part of that. They need to have respect for authority. There needs to be a respect for authority. And that is done, I told somebody the other day, Ron has been teaching us over and over that children have to have respect for parents or they won't have a respect for God. There is things that Ron has been teaching. He's gone, so I can say this. Ron has been teaching to us, and I realize sometimes it comes across too hard, it comes across too often, it comes across overbearing, but there is a truth in that truth. That we need to teach our children the respect for God. And that's done with punishment, with the rod, sparing the rod is a bad thing. Sparing the rod and negotiated child-raising methods and homes as democracies undermine authority. Our homes are not democracies. We are the head of the home, fathers and mothers. And don't criticize the ministry in front of the children. Number four, the church. We've been talking about that kind of in a lot of ways, but this is, I'm going to just speak about the church specifically here. You can have your Bible open to 1 Corinthians 10. You know, about 30 years ago, when the charity movement started, there was this realization that we must be born again. That we could be good church members and not born again. We could have, you know, good doctrine and church practices and not really grasp the heartbeat of God. We could have it all together and not really understand who God is. We could have traditions and practices in churches that hindered our walk with God. It actually and hindered our testimony for Jesus. And so, all right, okay. So we can be good church members, have all our ducks in a row, and not be right with God. So I guess the key is, let's get right with God. Good point. Galen, you were there in those days. But what happened was, somehow some of that got disconnected from the church. Yes, we can be church members and not be saved. The question is, can you be a part of the kingdom of God if you're not a part of the kingdom of God? How can you be a part of the household of God if you're not a household? You're not in the household. The assumption is, in the Bible assumes, all the way back to Genesis, certainly by the time of Moses, the idea was you were a part of the people of God. Now, I'm going to write my laws in your hearts. There never was an idea that somehow we could do it alone. So we wanted to go back to the core. Salvation, new birth, spirit-filled life, guided by the Word of God. But somehow, in trying to go back to the core, we left out the context. Because the context is the church. And always has been. The Bible's full of it. The context has always been the church of Jesus Christ. So, in Hebrews chapter 10, I mean, sorry, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We got Hebrews 10 too, but 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You're going to see a similar thought to what we've already read. Next, Romans, Corinthians. Thought I had it marked. I do. I'm just going to read 1 through 5. 1 through 5 is something you're very familiar with, I suppose. One of my favorite passages in the Bible, for some reason. Moreover, brethren, Apostle Paul speaking to the Corinthians, a church with a lot of problems, by the way. Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud, in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased. So this church in the wilderness, this group of God followers who were literally drinking from the rock, which is Christ, many of them, God was not well pleased. They fell in the wilderness. So obviously, it's possible to be a part of the people of God without being a part of the people of God. It's because they were not of faith. It goes on and speaks about that faith. So, all right, so can we just throw it? So since the reality is that you can be a church member without being saved, let's just throw out being a church member. I want you to notice, if you got your Bible open there, I hope you do, I want you to notice from, where does it start here? The 23rd verse. It just the same thought, just kind of continues on. And it talks about all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. And let's see here. I got a note here, the 24th verse. Let no man seek his own, but every man another's well-being. It says wealth there in the Old King James. That's not what it's talking about. It's not talking about wealth. It's talking about that our responsibility is to one another. So, all right, we can see that even in the very context that you can be in the church and not be saved, in the very context of that, we are responsible to one another to provoke one another to good works, because there is the possibility that our brother will fall away, our sister will fall away. We need to walk alongside of them. So I wanted you to see that connection. You know, we can talk about the new birth all day, but it's always in the context of the church. Being born again does not drive us to the church. Born again is to drive us to the church, not to take away the need for it. You know, I was listening to a testimony recently about a man who was in a Christian ministry, and he got into gambling online gambling, which is a thing now. There's a lot of things you can do online. He got in and he started stealing money from his employer, which his employer was actually a Christian parachurch organization. It's very intriguing how all that worked out. He basically confessed it to his boss and almost went to jail. His boss graciously said, if you'll pay it back, and it was a lot of money, he said, you won't have to go to jail. But he fired him. And what he did was he got plugged into his local church, which he hadn't been before. And he put himself accountable to about five other people, including his wife, on anything to do with the internet and his finances. And the point I'm getting out of that is that listening to his testimony, I came to the conclusion that I think he was a born-again man. He got caught in this addiction, and he went deeper and deeper into that. And he realized the only way to get out of it and stay out of it was to surround himself with the people of God who would hold him very, very accountable on a daily and weekly basis. And that, I think, is why it's so important to be a part of the Church of God. I have a lot of things I'd like to say about that, but I'm just going to make one more point about the church before I go into commitment. The fifth thing I'm going to talk about is commitment. I only have a few minutes left. A strongly built house. You know, you go to Eric's new house right now, and the basement door is open, and the windows look like they're going to fall apart, and there's several things wrong with that house. And if I would sleep in that house, I wouldn't feel very secure. I would probably assume some rats and mice and maybe a cockroach or two would go over my bed, and it would not be all that comfortable. But I could go to some of the rest of you's house and stay the night, and it'll get better someday. I go to the rest of you's house and, you know, tight windows, tight doors, the roof doesn't leak, the foundation's been redone. Wayne just redid his foundation, and I'm sure the basement's dry now. And we can sleep in there comfortably. You know, the church is not an end in itself. A church is a place to live inside of. You know, if we're always, you know, I told the brothers at Zion, you know, they kind of wonder, you know, these brothers' meetings are kind of hard. I said, hey, we're building the house. We're getting the structure. We're patching the roof and rebuilding the foundation. That the purpose is that we have a place to eat and to sleep and to fellowship. And, to, you know, that's where the warm food and the comfortable place to be is. A house, well-built, strong house, is a good place to be. And we feel more secure in that. I'll just use, and I hope this is a fair illustration, but it comes to my mind. Before the 2014 split, we were kind of a jiggly church. We were really wrestling. Things weren't feeling well, right? You all remember that, those of you who are here. And what happens when we don't have security is we become protection. We start kind of putting up the walls, and all of a sudden we don't feel very comfortable with those deviations. And people come, visitors come in, we feel kind of shaken and scared by them. But if we're solid, we're church knows who we are, we know where we're going, we're secure in Christ, we can have people come in that are not where they ought to be, and we're comfortable, it's okay. We're solid enough to take it. And I'm not probably getting this said right, but I just want us to understand that there is a beauty in a church that's unified, that has an identity, knows what we're going, knows who we are. And then we're in a lot better place to handle that unruly young person or that person that walks in the door. That's, you know, maybe the wife isn't even wearing a head covering, but here she's sitting. And because we're in that secure place that we know who we are and where we're at. So a strong, well-built church that is in a good place is not a oppressive thing. It's a secure thing. I'm going to maybe end Got a lot of things I want to say about it. I want to just talk about membership and commitment. I'm just going to read this last part here to you. I don't have time to do a lot of commenting. We had a membership commitment meeting at Zion, the 27th of July. And there was a lot of questions were coming my way on, you know, what does it mean? You know, of course, some were trying to figure out if they could kind of wiggle in without really making a commitment. Can I make a commitment without making a commitment? You know, you ever been around those kind of people? And there was some that were afraid that people were going to do that. And so they didn't want to make a commitment if there's going to be people there who weren't committed. So we had a lot of that going on. So I decided just to write up something. And I sent it to on their church chat just a day or so ahead of time before that commitment was made. And this is what I wrote. And it's 8 points. There's actually a few more that don't apply here, but I'm just going to put the points here I think apply in any church. Number one, membership is when the individual says to the church, me speaking to the church, this is a candlestick of Jesus, this is a candlestick church of Jesus Christ. You know, the Revelation 1 there. It's a candlestick church. It's a lampstand church. And when the church says to the individual, we believe that you are born again, child of God, washed in the blood of Jesus. So there's a two-way communication. I say to the church, I believe you're a church. And the church says to me, yes, I think you're a part of the church. And that's part of commitment. Number two, the church and the individual mutually acknowledge to one another they have shared values and shared directions and are compatible with one another enough to walk together. So that's part of commitment. Number three, membership commitment means that we are committed to walking together in practical harmony of lifestyle, being careful not to offend one another and to make practical decisions in light of one another's sensibilities and convictions in light of the Bible and hearing the Holy Spirit. Number four, we commit together to practice Matthew 18 in very practical ways to maintain harmony and regain peace when it is broken. This means that when questions arise, there's an honest attempt to resolve them before hastily leaving the church. That's what commitment means. We don't just hastily leave. Number five, there's a commitment to receiving and giving counsel. You notice I put the receiving first. There's a commitment to that. There's an expectation there will be no influence without investment. I hope you got that sentence. No influence without investment. If you're not committed, you shouldn't have invest. You shouldn't have influence. This means that at a brother's meetings and in the pulpit, there's a shared responsibility for the individual to first receive counsel and also to give counsel in a responsible way, befitting a sense of ownership and care for the future of the church and its health and welfare. Number six, commitment means brings a level of responsibility and accountability is mutually acknowledged by all. This does not mean there's no responsibility and accountability to those who will not make a commitment. Avoidance of formal commitment is not an escape from responsibility. For this reason, the church does not welcome long-term visitors, but rather we encourage people to get themselves into a church where they can fit in, plug in, open themselves up to receiving counsel, and become the building members of a God-honoring, Bible-believing church somewhere. Number seven, commitment is not merely a ticket to vote at our brothers' meetings, but rather a taking up the responsibility of becoming a mutual disciple or one of another. And number eight, this might answer some of the questions that's coming to your mind. Number eight, commitment does not constitute an oath of permanent fidelity to any particular local body of believers. There's a very real possibility that someone will feel led to leave one congregation and go to another for any number of reasons. But commitment means there will be a good communication and a willingness to be under authority throughout the process of moving somewhere else. I might write that up and put it on the tables for somebody to look at if you want to. And I think I will end there. But I'll just, there's some more things I've got on there, but I want to end before 12 if I can. I'm just going to read that phrase one more time. Ephesians 2:19. Therefore, you're no more strangers and pilgrims, no more strangers and foreigners, but, and I will add it in here, not no more citizens of America or the American dream, but in fellowship with the citizens and saints of God and the household of God. A little paraphrase there. So part two will be some of what I missed today, and 6 through 12, I think it is. God bless you.